welcome to BA Brew. I'm Lisa.
I'm Philippa.
And I'm Byron.
Welcome back, Byron. So Byron joined us a couple of years ago to talk about his book, Think Like a CEO. And since then, in the last couple of years, you've been really busy, Byron, haven't you? And I've got another later book called The Effective CEO 2.0, which is just another great read. And actually, it struck me how different it is from the last one I read. It's so different. I was expecting it to be quite similar, maybe a few updates here and there, but actually, it's very different. It's really interesting, engaging. And I think as well, there was a few bits of content that really stood the test of time that came through into the latest book. But like I say, so much of it was fresh and new. How's the last couple of years been for you and with the writing process and, you know, all the great stuff you've been doing with the coaching?
Yeah, it's been really exciting. The good thing about the books is it gave me so many opportunities to work with new people. Like at this point, I've worked with clients in 18 different countries now, from a range of different businesses, from startups to tech companies to AI businesses, retail companies, like financial institutions and unicorns in Silicon Valley. So that's just given me such a range of experience that it was really became time to update the previous book. That's why I wanted to do the 2.0 version, because in the 3-4 years between that and the first one, I obviously developed a lot of the ideas. I got a lot of new ideas and different case studies and examples. And I thought it'd just be a great opportunity to then express that and then start putting it in written form so it can go and help more people when they're navigating a lot of the challenges that I see in the clients I work with.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Yeah, so it's interesting. So you're able to put your experience into your latest book. So you've been able to do that. That's fantastic. So when I read through it, I'm not a CEO, but when I read through both books, actually, I did find that it wasn't just for CEOs. It could very much apply for me as a business analyst or any kind of employee, really, to deal with things like overwhelm and managing tasks effectively, that kind of thing. So I suppose my first question would be really, if I was an overwhelmed CEO or business analyst or, you know, any kind of professional, having a really, really hard week where every hour was accounted for, you know, I was really stressed about it and, you know, just jumping from one thing to the next, context switching. What advice would you give me in the moment, you know, at the beginning of this really hard week?
Yeah. So what most people do when they've got a really hectic, busy week is they just dive in and attack it. Their whole mindset is, I just need to get everything done. The problem with that, though, is it's very reactive. So you're essentially just going into the week and taking on things without really stopping to think about what you're doing and why. And that's why the best advice I'll give someone going into that is to actually slow down and think about what you're doing, because it's easy to convince yourself you don't have time to stop. But if you're about to work a 40, 50, 60 hour week, do you really not have 15 minutes to figure out how you're going to spend that time? So I would really advise everyone to just really think about, okay, what am I trying to achieve here? What are the things I need to get moved forward? What does success look like? And then once you know the outcome you want, audit everything you're taking on, sit down and go through, okay, what meetings do I have scheduled in? What other tasks have I got on my plate? What commitments are on my diary? And then your focus is to eliminate as much as possible. Because if you say you're in the middle of a really big project and that is your sole focus, and then you look at your week and you've got other meetings that really don't align with your goals, the best thing you could do is remove yourself from it. But if you haven't taken the time to slow down and audit what you're taking on, you're just going to go into them because they're in your diary. And I speak to so many people who convince themselves when they're busy, they can't stop, whereas actually that's the time they need to do it most, because those few minutes is going to make the difference between a highly focused and intentional week or you just dancing around feeling overwhelmed and not really thinking about what you're doing.
Yeah, that's excellent advice, because I probably am that kind of person where I just think, oh, right, I'll just work through it. You know, I'll just go to the next meeting. I'll prepare for the one after that. You know, I just try and attack the week that way. But actually, you're right. There's definitely, I could spare 10, 15 minutes to sit and think about what I'm doing. So that's really great advice. Philippa, you're the target audience for this book because you've founded companies, you've been on the board of a PLC. How did the book resonate with you, and what's your experience?
Yeah, well, Byron, I wish I'd had the book 20 years ago, quite honestly. Some of the things I had to learn the hard way, but even I took some real nuggets of learning from it. I think your comment, planning is literally your job. When you're in the CEO or a leadership position for a business, it really is. And if you don't make time to really take a good hard look at what you're spending your time on, it's going to impact the success of the business that you're in. But when you work for a small company or a smaller business, we tend to run on lean principles. We don't tend to have lots of available people to do the work. And it's quite tempting to just dive in and take everything on yourself, because there's kind of an expectation that the CEO, MD, or even if you're in any kind of management position, that you have to be the expert in everything. And an old boss once said to me, he was a CEO, "I aim to be the second best at everything in the company." And I never really quite understood what he meant until I'd been doing the job of MD for a few years and had got exactly into this kind of trap that you talk about in the book, where you feel you just have to be brilliant at everything. You're a perfectionist, but what you're not good at necessarily is understanding the talent that you have around you and the ability as a leader to work through people rather than give them instructions, tell them exactly what they need to do, thereby putting yourself under far too much pressure, which comes into kind of the planning that you were talking about. And one thing I really loved in your book was the not to-do list. So part of the audit maybe is to actually look at what expertise you've got around you in terms of other people. And I'd be interested to hear what you feel about that, this challenge of not being the expert, not having to do everything, obviously related to planning, but it can actually free you up to focus on more important things.
Yeah. One of the biggest things I see, especially new leaders, struggle with is the whole mindset of recognizing that when you're a leader, it's not on you to do everything. Your job is to surround yourself with the right people, get their ideas, their input, and their opinion, and then you make a decision on what to do. But so many, especially first-time leaders, put their pressure on themselves that they need to have all the answers and just waste time where they find stuff out that isn't the good use of their day. And it's a very big adjustment to being at peace with the fact of, do you know what? The people around you are the experts. That's why they've been brought into that position. And part of that as well is also redefining what your role actually is, because when you step into a leadership position, it's no longer about you doing the doing. That's what your team are for. But because you're so used to that, you've normalized it. Whether you're an engineer, you're a technician, a designer, whatever it is, you're so used to ticking stuff off and moving it forward that that's where you feel comfortable. And this is why so many people struggle making that transition, because they're not seeing a tangible output to their time. So they feel like they're not being productive, whereas actually stepping back, processing problems, leading their team and setting the strategy is where their time has the greatest impact. And this is where they become their own worst enemy, because they're like, oh, but I should be doing stuff. So they get stuck in the weeds, wasting their time on things that could be done on by someone else. And that's why it's such a big mindset shift to transition from doing to leading. And the people who don't get it right, they're the ones who become the bottleneck, or they overstep, they micromanage, and they just waste their days on things that aren't actually driving growth. And that's why the best advice I'll give to anyone listening to this, if you've stepped into a leader position, you really need to figure out, where does your time have the greatest impact? What can only be done by you? And what is your zone of genius? Because when you figure out that, you can clearly define your role and responsibilities. And then it goes back to the time audit. You look at everything you're taking on through the lens of, should this actually be done by me, or should I delegate this and give it to someone else? The more you can do that, the more you can step back and focus on working on instead of in the business.
Yeah, that's brilliant advice. What I'd be interested in is in your coaching, and from my experience, when people move into a senior position, so it's the top role in the company, or if they founded the business, you know, all of this makes logical sense, is to look at who you've got around you and really leverage their expertise. But I think if we're honest as executives, maybe ego plays a part in putting us in these kind of difficult positions where we feel we have to do everything. And I was wondering what your experience was as a coach in particular of moving people from this sort of sense of themselves as a leader, that if they allow other people to take the lead, in effect, that's they somehow don't like it.
It depends on the person, but there's very much a mixture going on here, because whenever someone struggles to delegate and let go, either they haven't hired the right people or they haven't done a good enough job in setting their team up for success. Because I speak to so many leaders who say to me that they struggle delegating because they worry either it's not going to get done or the person's going to make mistakes or they're not going to be able to do it as well as them. That's why they convince themselves that it's better or quicker just to do it on their own. And in some situations, that may be true. But if you're constantly taking on tasks that should be let go to someone else, and you know that you've got great people around you, that's a sign that you're not doing a good enough job as a leader to really give them what they need. Because when it comes to effective delegation, so many people just hand stuff off and hope for the best. But what you've got to realize is you have so much added context and information that other people don't. You also know the goals and the vision and what you're trying to drive forward. And that's why you can't afford to be in that mindset of just trying to execute and operate at pace, because all that's going to happen is mistakes are going to get made or people aren't going to get it right. And that's why as a leader, you have to get comfortable with slowing down. You've got to figure out, okay, what does this person need? What can I communicate to them? How can I teach them how to do it? Because all you taking everything on yourself is going to do is keep it on your plate. So yeah, it may take a little bit of extra time now, but down the line, it's going to give them what they need to do to take it over, which is going to free you up. And again, this goes back to people being their own worst enemies, where they want everything done and they want it done now. So it's making that short-term decision that comes at the expense of their long-term progress.
Yeah, no, that's great. To pick on something you were talking about is, you know, making mistakes. In your book, I was, you know, really interested to read all about the growth mindset. And as an apprentice mentor, developing a growth mindset is something we spend quite a lot of time at Assist in supporting our apprentices in that way, because that's the way they're going to learn. And not to be afraid of making mistakes along the way. And speaking as, you know, of a former MD, I think it's something you can develop in yourself, a growth mindset, making mistakes. But actually, have you found the people that you're working with maybe are less tolerant of the mistakes other people make in their own learning journey? And the temptation is if you have a member of your team, you maybe think, yeah, I'm going to delegate this piece of work to them. It's quite important, but it's the first time they've done it, so they mess up. If we're really honest as senior executives, maybe the first few times we'll dive in, we'll do it ourselves, and maybe we won't give them a similar piece of work again. And that is so counterproductive. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. You write really articulately about this in the book, but it's a slightly different perspective from developing your own growth mindset, is actually supporting growth mindset in others who work for you.
If someone says that their team keeps making mistakes and not getting stuff right, my first place to look is how common is this of a problem? Because if it's just an isolated incident where it's one team member, then that could be a sign that maybe that person isn't cut out for the job. But if it's a multitude of people, that for me is a red flag that the leader isn't doing a good enough job setting their team up for success. I've seen this with so many clients I work with where so many of their team aren't getting stuff right, and it's because they're not communicating expectations. They're not being clear on what needs to get done. They're not slowing down to really help them understand what they need to do. And then, as I always say to clients, you can't get frustrated that someone makes mistakes if you haven't actually shown them what they need to do to make this done effectively. And that's why my first thing, which I always say to them, is look, where is this coming in? Is it across the whole team, which is maybe a red flag that you're not doing a good enough job as a leader? Or is it, like I said, with one person, and then just being really honest of, okay, do they need further development? Or is it a case in some situations someone can't do it? Like, not everyone's cut out to do particular tasks, and that's also okay. But you can't just jump straight to the mindset of everyone's rubbish. They can't do everything as well as me. I'm never going to be able to get this off my plate, because that's not true. But so many people jump straight to that conclusion without really honestly evaluating the situation. And talking about growth mindset, I'd love to circle back to one of the things we were talking about before we dived into this session of, as a leader, you've also got to recognize that not everyone thinks and behaves the same way that you do. I've had so many conversations with clients who they look at their team and they think, because when they were working their way up as a high achiever, they just got stuff done. They saw a task and they figured it out and moved it forward. And they then reflect on their team, convincing themselves that everyone thinks and behaves the same way that they do. And what I always have to remind them is they're CEO or an executive for a reason. They have that drive. They have that ambition. And just because they operate that way doesn't mean the rest of their team do. And this is why it's really important to recognize that people thrive on accountability. It'll bring out the best in your high performers, but it'll also uncover where your low performers maybe aren't delivering. And as your job as a leader to really put that in place, you can't shy away from it or avoid it just because it's hassle. You think people should be following through with stuff. And there's also, to take it a step further as well, of your entire team aren't going to be A players. You see it so often of people being like, I need all A players in my team to help us grow and thrive. But the reason that doesn't work is your A players don't want to do the boring grunt tasks that your B and C players will do. So that's why you need the B and C players in there who are going to do the everyday tasks, the admin, the data entry, the stuff that keeps the business running. You need that balance, because otherwise things are going to get dropped and your operational issues aren't going to get done. I think this is really where, as a leader, you've got to take a step back. And it goes back to the planning that we talked about, of really looking at the business on a whole. Be like, okay, what people do I need in different places? How do I then develop them and set my A players up for success? And then make sure my B and C players are there supporting them so that we can continue to grow.
So, yeah, I 1,000% agree with all that. Again, it's something that you kind of, you know, it takes a long time to learn. Or maybe not learn. Some people never learn it, but it sounds to me like you know, the recommendation is to get to know your people as individuals, to understand what drives them, what motivates them. As you say, some people are the A players. They want a career. They're motivated. They're ambitious. They're always looking for the next challenge. They'll put themselves forward for pieces of work. They might be coming up with ideas. Brilliant. But actually, other people just want the satisfaction of coming to work and seeing the job well done. They earn their money. But actually, what motivates them is maybe something different. It may be outside work. Work is a means to an end rather than an end in itself. And I think that's a fundamental realization for anybody in a leadership role, is you've got different people in your team. And as you say, Byron, it's understanding who your people are, where they fit, so that you can work with them in the best way to move the organization forward towards, you know, the goals that you've set for it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Just to further build on your point, like, that's the importance of knowing your people. I had this conversation with a client recently of my favorite TV show of all time is Suits. I don't know if you've seen it, but like the example I was giving to her.
I know Meghan Markle was in it.
Well, yeah. Yeah. In one of the episodes, they're doing an evaluation of their different employees. And there's one guy that they found where he sat in the office, all of the people around him do their job better because he sets them up for success. He's not the A player and the top performer. He's a solid B player. But because of how he's organized and he supports people and how he sets them up for success, they all do their job better. I think it's just a great way of highlighting that you can overlook that. If you don't know your people, you can be like, oh, that guy's not as good. That like person isn't as like high achiever, whereas actually they're the ones who are giving everything else that the A players need. And that was the point I was making. Like, you need that mix, and you also need to evaluate people in different ways. Just because someone's not the best salesperson doesn't mean that they're not adding value in different areas. It's so easy just to judge the output of someone if they've generated X amount of revenue or they've done some certain thing, and you overlook the other characteristics that really are impactful in the business in different ways.
Yeah, Yeah, because some people are really the glue that holds the organization together. They're maybe not the stars whose achievements get celebrated regularly, but without them, things will fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm. I mean, great, great points. Just to go back to your point about the zone of genius, Byron, what do you mean by that? Is that like things that you're good at yourself and that perhaps that's your selling point, I suppose? What's the description?
Your zone of genius is essentially the areas that you thrive. It's really figuring out, like, okay, if you spend more of your time operating in this zone, it would drive business growth, create more revenue, have the biggest impact on the company. Because a lot of people know what their weaknesses are, and then they'll spend loads of time and energy trying to get marginally better. And the advice I always give is to instead hire around your weaknesses, delegate those tasks to other people and stop wasting energy on them, and instead free yourself up to really focus on the areas that drive growth. And this is going to be different for everyone. Someone, it might be marketing, it might be sales, it might be strategy, it might be building the right team. It's really figuring out, okay, where do you thrive? What is it that you really excel in? And then spend more of your days doing that.
Yeah. That's fantastic advice, because you do tend to focus on the things that you're not good at or the development areas. And actually, that's a really good way of looking at it. I suppose it's best foot forward for you as part of a wider team. Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned as well push and pull days, which I really love that concept in your book. Just would you mind just explaining a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Let me just share the example from the book, because I think it'll be easier for people to see it in context. So I was working with a CEO who came to me who was absolutely crushing Monday and Tuesday. He was energized. He was focused. He was moving forward everything he needed to do. Come Wednesday, though, he was starting to feel a little bit low on energy. He wasn't as productive. By Thursday, it was even worse. And Friday was a complete write-off. When I started looking at how he was approaching his days, he was going full steam ahead Monday and Tuesday to the point there was very little gas left in the tank for the rest of the week. So what I advised him was we needed to restructure his weeks in a way that he implemented what I call push days, which are the days you go all out, and pull days where you step back and you recharge. So at first, he was really reluctant to do this. He was like, no, I need to be highly focused and productive and effective every single day. But what I said is, like, let's just try and see what happened. So the way we implemented it was on a Wednesday, he'd pull back. He'd sleep in. He'd have a later start to the day. He'd have less meetings and lower bandwidth tasks. He would then finish the day early, go to the gym, get a massage, do whatever he wanted to do. And he found was that by stepping back on a Tuesday, Wednesday, I mean, he would get his energy up to the point they would come back in on a Thursday and Friday with the same energy from Monday and Tuesday. So he essentially went from having two highly effective days a week to four, simply by changing his approach. Because most people try and have the same routine every single day. They want to have the same habits, the same behaviors. They want to be consistent. And while that's better than nothing, it's not optimal. And just to give you a different example, I had a lady I was working with who, she works in London a couple of days a week, and she found that on the days that she was getting the train in, she has to wake up early, she then doesn't get back till late at night, and she was always pressuring herself of, I still need to work out, I need to make dinner for the kids, I need to do all these different things, and inevitably, she would never get to it. And instead, by implementing the push and pull day, it took that pressure off herself, because she could see, okay, the London days are push day. I'm not going to even try and put the expectation on myself to do everything else, because I know I'm not going to get to it. Instead, on the days I'm working from home, I'll pull back. That's when I might start my day by exercising. I'll go for a walk at lunchtime. I will have some time to support the kids and be the parent. And it just took all of that extra anxiety off her of trying to be consistent with everything every single day. And that's why I love that strategy, because it's all about a longevity approach, where rather than just treating every single day in isolation, you're looking at your performance over the course of a week and then really seeing of, okay, this is when I'm going harder. So maybe I need to pull back a bit so I can get my energy up so I can come back stronger the next day, which a lot of people don't do, because they're always like, I need to go, go, go. And it's just a very different mindset shift about sustainability and not burning out.
Yeah, this resonates so much with me. And going back a few years, the talk was all around work-life integration. So to blur the boundaries of your personal life and your professional life. And I've found my lived experience of that is that it wasn't work-life integration. It was work all the time, to the point where, as a, particularly as a, the founder of a business, I did an Everest Base Camp trek, and I was answering work emails, you know, halfway up there, in, you know, low oxygen, tea houses, environment in the tea houses. And I thought, this is mad, actually. And I'm not sure if I like this idea of push days and pull days, because work-life integration for me just resulted in working 24/7, and it had an impact on family. It had an impact on me, and you end up feeling really quite burned out by it all. So again, I kind of learned the hard way a little, and made sure then, you know, to schedule appropriate time to recharge. So I wish I'd had this advice before. I'm just wondering what your thoughts were around this sort of work-life integration concept.
Yeah. Well, the advice I give in the book, and also to clients, it's so many people just try and find this balance where they leave it down to chance. They wake up and they're like, hopefully today I'll get to the gym, or I'll make it home in time for dinner. But the problem with that is there's no intentionality there. And that's why the advice I always give is you need to figure out, I call it in the book, ideal life creation. It's really like, what are the non-negotiables, the things that are important to you, and then build your schedule around that. Because one of the examples I give in where I talk about is a CEO who, he was having problems in his marriage, and he kept trying to schedule date night with his wife, but he would do it on a day where he had back-to-back meetings. So inevitably, they would either overrun, or he would be so stressed that when he got to dinner, all he could think about was work. So we had to then restructure it in a way. If we looked at, okay, what does he do in those hours building up to it? We removed meetings, we took on low bandwidth tasks so he could finish on time, and he'd also be calm and not just like stressed and wired. And this is why, for me, a lot of this is self-inflicted. Because going back to your example of being a founder, we have this mindset of everything needs an immediate response. An email or a fire comes in, or someone asks for help with a problem. And what we do is we drop everything to dive in and try and fix it. But all that does is it creates a culture where people aren't relying on themselves. I had this conversation with a client the other day who was frustrated that a member of his team just keeps bugging him throughout the day, asking for questions and help and support. And inevitably, he just stops what he's doing to help her. And I said, you're not pushing her to grow and develop. And also, by solving a problem, it doesn't leave her time to figure it out. So what I told him to do is the next time she comes, push back, say, look, what I'll do is I want you to go have a look at this and then come back at 2 o'clock today and we can talk about it. And he found that what happened is she then went, looked at different answers, and she figured it out. So when he asked her at 2 o'clock, what do you need from me? She was like, oh, I've solved it now. But because in the past he was diving straight in, it wasn't giving her an environment where she could actually do that. And that's why the best advice I always give to people is if your team keeps coming to you to solve their problems, you need to push back. Say to them, look, I need you to go away, look into this, research it, figure out three potential solutions, and then come back to me with your recommendations. Because by doing so, it forces people to think for themselves. Then they'll either come to the outcome, or they'll come back with a good idea of information, and you can discuss it further and determine what to do about it. This is transitioning from the problem solver to the person who empowers their team. Very big different shift. But as a founder, it's just so easy to be like, see a problem and dive in. And all that does is it keeps you stuck in the weeds, where you also then create a culture of dependency where people don't take ownership for themselves. It's a very uncomfortable shift to make. But once you do, and you start seeing that by giving the people the opportunity to step up, they're a lot more capable than you're giving them credit for.
I agree. That's an absolute golden nugget. And I think it has a massive impact on motivation in the longer term as well, when people feel trusted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. It really is such an interesting thing. And I think how lucky people are, Byron, to have you in their corner helping them with their day jobs, and obviously the you know, in turn the success of their company as well. I think it must be lovely to have that support. This has been such a wonderful session. Have either of you got any final takeaways for the audience based on what we've discussed today? Philip, I'll come to you first.
Oh, come to me first. I just say get Byron's book. I wish I'd had it 20 years ago. And also, I know, Byron, I have signed up for some of your resources as well, because I definitely learned some new tips from the book. I am going to do a not to-do list. That's something that I need to do. And I look forward to receiving some of the resources because I'm sure they'll be brilliant. So that's my takeaway. Some real golden nuggets in the conversation today. Thank you.
Thanks, Philippa. And Byron, yourself?
Yeah. And one last point that I'd just like to leave this on to get people to think about what they're doing is this actually goes back to my Think Like a CEO book introduction, where the example that I talk about in there is there was a study from the Colson School of Management where they found that the best sales people go on to become the worst sales managers. The reason being is the skills aren't transferable. Just because someone's great at one thing doesn't mean they know how to manage others or teach the skill to other people. And this is why you really need to understand that what made you great in your role or what got you to where you are today isn't going to get you to where you want to be. And if you really want to become an effective leader, you really need to focus on, okay, how do I empower others? How do I communicate expectations? How do I hold people accountable? Because those are the soft skills that will really make you effective in your role. And it's a very uncomfortable transition to make because going back to what we've already spoken about, a lot of people are so used to doing the doing that their tendencies will just be to want to dive in. But if you really want to run a company, regardless of the leadership level, like this isn't just applicable to CEOs, this is applicable to people at every stage of stepping into management, you have to learn to really trust people. But doing so means setting them up for success, where it's not just you solving their problems or diving in or fixing it for them. It's you actually taking the time to figure out, what do they need? How do I develop them? How do I really give them the tools and the mindset and the way and the process to make sure they can follow through? If you get that right, not only will you see better results in your team, it'll also make your life so much easier because you're not constantly going to have to be working 60 hours taking everything on yourself. So I'll just encourage everyone listening to really have an honest evaluation of, okay, if I step back, look at my team, how are they operating? And then what are the things that are missing that will allow them to perform better? Because a lot of the time, it may be a very tough pill that you need to swallow if you're not doing your job well enough. And that's not a negative. That's not about beating yourself up and dwelling on and being like, I'm a rubbish leader. It's like, no, it's like, look at, okay, what could I do better? And some of the times, maybe you need to speak to them. Maybe you need to go and ask, like, what could I do to support you better? Where am I maybe not giving you the things you need to do your job properly? This is all about actually then building the awareness across all levels that's going to make everyone better.
Absolutely. No, thank you so much. Such great advice there. Really great advice. Thank you both for joining me today. Thank you for our audience for listening or watching the podcast. If you've got any ideas for any future BA Brews, please do let us know at our email address, which is babrew@assistkd.com. And please do like, share and subscribe to our channel. Thank you.